group insurance program. Welcome, Deputy Commissioner Larson, and why don't you... told me earlier there's some good news, so we'd like to hear news once in a while around here. Good morning.
Thank you, Senator, members of the committee. Well, I'd say there's good news and some what I would call responsible news that we're here to share with you today. And to my right, I have Mr. Dave Haugen. Dave is the director of our Center for Healthcare Purchasing. Dave and I have worked closely together for the last probably 15 years in the area of managing our insurance program. We're here today, Senator and members of the committee, to give you kind of what I would call a health status report, the state employee group insurance program, and then finally to conclude on just kind of where we are with the bargaining process, because we have opened with the unions, and we thought it would be prudent and wise, because our contracts come in front of this committee, that we would share with you a little bit of the where we are with respect to the bargaining process. I have before you two handouts, and I'd like to call your attention to the ones we have on our screen this morning, and that report that we prepared for the presentation today. And I guess I'd just like to start out, if you can just go through the documents. I'll give you a little bit of history of this for the members of this committee that are new. The State Employee Group Insurance Program, which is commonly referred to as CGIP, ensures the state employees throughout the executive branch, but we insure 115,000 lives, and that's 48,000 state employees that are eligible for that. But I think it's important to note that we oversee the insurance program for the executive branch, the judicial branch, the legislative branch, MNSCU, and then we have a variety of independent billing units. For example, the Minnesota Historical Society, labor unions that represent state employees are also part of this conglomerate of people that we consider to be part of our group. And then also in addition to that, if you're a state employee and you've been a state employee for more than 5 years and retired and you're under age 65, there's also a tremendous benefit for you, and that is that you're eligible to stay in our pool for purposes of risk pool. And so the premium, even though you pay it yourself, is applicable to the active state employee group. So if you're 64 years old and you retire, your premium rate is if you were a 24-year-old, and that's a tremendous benefit for the post-retirees that are under age 65. Now, that begs the question, what about the retirees that are over 65? And that is that they're in their own pool that we also manage, and there is a comprehensive program that we have with our Medicare program, and the law also requires that the post-65 retiree group has to have the same benefit design as the underage 65 group, and so it's coordinated with Medicare, and they have their own risk pool for that point.
Senator Scheid is really listening to you, because she turned 65 this month.
In June.
June.
Yeah, a month ahead of time.
A few weeks ago. Representative Hilser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is this only for people who are retired from all employment? They're still eligible? Or someone who, say, you know, retires from state employment but has employment elsewhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, if a person retired from the state and went to work somewhere else, let's say, for example, Acme Manufacturing, and they were not a state employee, they would still have the right to be part of our group. If Acme Manufacturing had an insurance plan that they were providing for their post-65 retirees, that employee would probably choose the best of the two as far as which one was making the most contribution. And in some instances, they would also be able to have a coordinated benefit system as well. Okay, did I answer that? I want to make sure. We do have state employees that quit, that leave, that go to work for other employers, and do not stay part of our pool. And one of the reasons is that our insurance program is so comprehensive, it's so expensive, that it's highly likely that and that's one of the things we're facing with our post-65 group, and that is that if you've got any possible positive health condition, you're getting out. And the reason being is that the premiums are so, like I said, though, it's very comprehensive. You know, the prescription benefit, the coverage is so comprehensive. But if you don't use it, you're paying a lot of money. And so what we have is we have people that are leaving the post-65 group, and then the people that can't leave are staying in the group. And so as a result of that, the premiums are difficult to manage. And I've been wrestling with this for years, which is that can we create a plan that post-65 retirees can purchase, which would be probably more cost efficient and responsible, and the risks that they're willing to take, you know, maybe a $5,000 deductible or something like that, and run it side by side with the comprehensive plan. And it's, we haven't gotten to that yet, but we are continuing to look at that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Larson, if you retire before 65, which I'm not going to do, but
that'd be in the next 3 weeks.
That would be.
Excuse me.
It's true.
Can I continue after? You know, can you continue after you're 65 then, or do you go into? You fall into that post 65. You must. And Mr. Hawk is nodding yes.
If you are over age 65. Excuse me, I'm going to have Dave answer that question. And you're still employed. Okay, Dave, answer.
Well, if you're over 65 and an active employee, you're with the active group.
Okay. Right.
But if you're retired and over 65 and choose to get your Medicare supplement through the state, it would be a Medicare supplement that's pooled with other over 65-year-old people that you would be paying entirely for yourself.
Okay.
The advantage. How long can you do that? Can you do that forever if you're retired? I mean, you'd be in the same pool, but you have to pay your own premiums, obviously. It's not a 1 or 2 year deal. You can keep going under this plan if you're retired?
Mr. Chair, yes. So long as you, there's actually, I believe, two sets of rules. For general state employees, they have a window at the time that they retire to choose to continue with the state over 65 group. If they don't take advantage of that window, they can't come in again. Mm-hmm. If at some point farther down the road they leave, they can't come in again. However, legislators have the ability to both go in and come back. And so that's the one unique factor about that that particular administration.
There was something in the paper a while back. Yeah, somebody got back in. Or another Secretary Wergen. I notice you're the secretary. So
it's a tough job, but I think I can handle it.
Well, title.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Wergen. Thanks. I thought we changed that two
Mr.
years
Chair,
ago.
Mr. Chair, we tried.
But
it's still there.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a... Some would consider it abuse a while back, but
well, Mr. Chairman,
if we get there, though, you might think it's a good idea, though. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Larson, Mr. Hoggett, I'm one of those people that probably I'm going to be one of those expensive people after 65. If you're treating cancer, I've got to believe you're considered expensive. And so, you know, I could be one of those people staying in. I don't know. It seems to me you're describing the idea that you're describing probably makes a whole lot of sense for those of us who are left there because we can't afford anything else. Would be a good idea. It's almost like an MCHA or something for us. I mean, am I right? Could you maybe do something like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think MCHA is actually cheaper.
I wondered. Okay.
But it's less of you're in a very, very, very comprehensive coverage after post 65. And would I be safe to say that MCHA is cheaper?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I think it would depend on how you're comparing it, if it's apples to apples. There certainly probably are MCHA policies or policies available in the private market that might be less expensive. They may not be as comprehensive.
Yeah, right, right.
But again, to your point about the ability to stay with the program, in the private sector, if you don't take advantage of certain open enrollment opportunities and try to come in with an existing health condition, that could also be problematic.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've gone over the difference for legislators who are over 65, but what about, say, a legislator who leaves the legislature, say, around 30 or 40 years old? Are they eligible to buy into the under 65 or continue on the under 65 plan? And then does the same in and out apply to them as well?
Sure.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Hilton, that's correct. And, you know, it was something that was put in place, I think, years ago when health care wasn't as focused and as visible as what this is. But, in effect, you could have a person that's a legislator that leaves, goes to no insurance, and 6 years later develops a serious medical condition, can call up and say, sign me up, and we have to do it.
And then if they leave again, are they able to leave and then come back again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilton, correct. This even applies to life insurance.
Hmm. Ooh. Oh, goodness sake. Hmm.
Good plan.
Right. That's a good. Okay. Good plan. Go ahead. Let's continue.
Continuing on to page 3, we're very, very, I think, proud of some of the concepts that we have with our Advantage program, because we do, as I said, provide a very comprehensive coverage for our employees, but we also have, to the extent possible, an element of what I believe responsible consumerism in how our Advantage program is designed. And the first part of our program, our plan, I should say, has that we have four cost levels that we've identified in our insurance program, which those of you that are members of Advantage and have experienced open enrollment will understand, and that is that you have level 1, level 2, level 3, and level 4, and we've determined the designation of the clinic system to these cost levels based on a very strategic, methodical analysis of where the most cost-efficient clinics are. And so what we're trying to do is reward the clinic systems that are providing what we believe to be the best services for the cost. And this is a design that was established and has put together by Johns Hopkins University years ago that we've worked with, that we've developed, and these are what we call responsible positions. And when we looked at it, the interesting thing when that was is that for the same medical procedure, when we first started looking at this, for the same medical procedure, the cost variance for that, depending on what clinic you choose, ranged up to 45% in cost. And so what we did was we looked at where these natural breaks would be, and our goal is to encourage our employees to make wise decisions. And what we did was we guaranteed level 2 access for everybody statewide. And so, we're trying to make this as what I would call balancing our desires for the competition out there with respect to the employees for making sure that they have coverage. And so as a result of that, the tiering has worked very well for us. And I can give you some examples where we had this one community where we, for years, we had a level 2 clinic and designation, the hospital and the clinic, and it insured about probably 2,000 of our state employees. And we had another clinic system 15 miles away that was level 3 when we first established the tiering. And the next round, when we negotiated with the health plans, we changed clinics, and we said that the one that had been level 2 is now level 3, and the one that had been level 3 is now going to be level 2. And the one that we changed and said you're going to be level 3 submitted another bid and came down to level 2. So where we have competition, this system works, and it works very well. Where we don't have competition, we subsidize. And we're continually struggling with that. If we were to do natural tiering, for example, and say where you land in our cost system is what you're going to pay, a majority of our employees in greater Minnesota would not have access to level 2 clinics. It would more than likely be level 3 or level 4. It costs us $7 million a year to subsidize those clinics to stay in level two, which is what we guaranteed when we put this together. And so it's a balance, and we're continually trying to be creative in the area of trying to have competition. As you know, years ago we had low-cost carrier, and that worked for about 10 years. And what happened was some of the health plans ended up drying up. And they were the only show in town, some of them, and so as a result of that, that happened. But right now, this is working. And I think I covered number two on page three, which is that if you pick a higher-tiered clinic, the costs and co-pays, deductibles, and stuff are higher. Now, the bottom of page three is the question is often asked, what does this have to do with quality? You know, we seem to be focused on costs. And the question is a tier two clinic cutting medical treatments, and are they fudging in that area? And that's just simply not the case. And we've gone to great extents. We've done surveys to make sure that that is not the results of our tiering of the clinic. And there's a program that we have called the Community Measurement Program, which actually is a rating. It's an independent rating that's provided for the healthcare systems in Minnesota. The employees can have, or people that are covered by insurance can actually get into this database to see how their clinic rates and how they respond to certain medical conditions. And when you have open enrollment, it's on our website. So when you're in the fall, when we have open enrollment and you have a certain medical condition, you want to see how your clinic fares in a ranking with that, you can access that during open enrollment. And if you look on, continuing on with my presentation, then on the following page, which would be page four, here's an example of that page with respect to diabetes. And these are actual clinics. This is information on the website. So if you're clinic is the Camden Clinic or Winona Clinic, Health Partner Central, and you have someone in your family who has diabetes, you can see just how they rank in that area of quality. And the other interesting thing, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and that is when you look at how this stacks up, we have level four clinics that are not in those three-star categories. We have level three clinics that are not in those three-star categories, and we have level two clinics that are. And so there is no distinction whatsoever that a level one or a level two clinic is cutting in the area of quality. There's been no correlation whatsoever in that area.
If you have diabetes, you ought to be living in Winona. How's that work?
Well,
there's no portability. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to ask, what does the rate mean? That I just wondered about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, the rate is the rate at which the patients, the diabetic patients in that particular clinic group, are getting what's considered by doctors to be optimal care for diabetes. I think one of the interesting things, as chart also points out, is that even among the best clinics, only 23% of their diabetics are getting what doctors consider to be the optimal care for their diabetes.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, is this based on all of their patients or just the CGIP people?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, this comes from a private nonprofit group that has involvement by all the health plans. They're doing a sampling of all commercial members, so it includes not only CGIP but the commercial population.
And then just one personal kind of question, is that Health Partners Medical Group all of the Health Partners clinics, or is that just one?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, that would be all of Health Partners, the Health Partners Medical Group.
Not just Central Minnesota. Okay. Sure.
Yep. Okay, continuing on, Senator, on page five, as again I think I've already emphasized this, our Advantage program, the key features are employee and family, choosing the providers. They can move through the clinic system, that choice, one through four. And again, we're providing the incentive for our clinic system. There is an incentive to be designated a level two clinic from the fact that that's where our employees are more than likely about, I think the number is about 85% of our people, or 80% of our people, choose level two clinics. So there's a tremendous incentive for those clinics to be designated as a level two clinic. And then finally, based on the variances of cost sharing, it also instills responsibility in our employees and our members to use our health care benefit system wisely, because there are costs associated with some of the choices. Continuing on the following page, we're happy to say that the Advantage program has received, we received an award last year from the Council on State Governments regarding the innovative approach that we've had with health care for our population. It was also referenced in an article on MedPAC, which is a medical publication with regard to Medicare, and the article referenced that we should take a look at what the state of Minnesota has put together. And then we're very proud that that in the 2006 year, the design changes that we made to Advantage brought us in with a zero premium increase for 2006. That's the good news. I also want to share with you, just I think I, for the lay of the land, I think it would be wise for you to know and to make sure we are all aware of what the cost of this program is. And then on page 7, currently for the insurance year that we're in right now, we had a 9.9 or 9.8% increase in insurance from the previous year. And so you can see that the employer is contributing $461.2 million toward that 2007 insurance year, and 43.4% is borne by the employees. And you can see that for the year, calendar year 2007, that's $504 million. We're in kind of what I would call a mixed sense, anticipating a 12% premium for 08 and 09. And so plugging in the 12% premium increases, you can see on the bottom two columns there what that's translating to as far as costs are concerned.
Mr. Larson, you started out the meeting by saying a lot of good news, but when the premiums go up 10% last year and projected to go up 12% next year and the year after, we're waiting for the good news, I guess.
Again, more news.
Nice to be. Is that a Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me how many employees this is for, then, these total numbers?
Not that 48,000?
48, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom has 48,000 insurance-eligible employees.
Okay. And Representative Bigham?
Kind of on what Senator Metzen said is if the insurance premium went up 9% last year, now it's 12 for this upcoming year and following years, what has increased that so dramatic? I guess it's not dramatic, but I mean, what's the deal with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, I am going to get to that, and so I do have an explanation.
We'll wait.
I'm patient.
Okay. I'm impatient, but we're still going to wait.
And I am a patient.
And you are a patient. Okay.
And you're pretty quick.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to note that one of the balancing acts that we have, that I have in labor relations, and that is our insurance year is a calendar year, and our contract years are fiscal year. And so whenever we talk about numbers, it's very important that we have to make sure that we distill our costs and that we're able to, you know, when we report to the committee on the costs of the contracts, is that 18 months of insurance or 24 months of insurance? And so the information that we're providing to you today is the calendar year insurance costs. And so we will continue to make sure that when we present information to this committee that you're aware of those numbers as we do that. Okay, I think I've covered on page 8, again, the components of our Advantage program, emphasizing, again, employee choice, the flexibility, and cost. Now, getting to Representative Ingham's comments here, some of the costing information, and I think it's also important to note that, Senator and members of the committee, and that is that our level of sophistication in our database is so precise now. We don't know who, but we certainly know the data. We know how many people are being treated for diabetes. We know how many people are being treated for cancer. We know how many people are being treated for high blood pressure. We know how many heart transplants we have. We know how many office visits we have. We have all of that information. And so because of our ability to look at that data, it provides us with a variety of opportunities to look at, if we don't do anything, what's going to continue to happen? What can we do to ameliorate some of these costs? And so just now in the next three or four pages, I'll get to you on just some of our data. And that is that it is staggering. But if you look at for 2005, and that's the current claims data that we have, we've just concluded 2006, and we will have the 2006 data probably within about a month. But I think this is reflective of what we're looking at here. And you can see that of our, on average, per member, we're spending $3,482 of insurance costs, and that has increased 10% in from 2003-2004 insurance year to the 2005 insurance year. And then consistent with all insurance programs, 20% of our members are generating 80% of our costs. And that number, when you look at health providers out there, you know, good news is hopefully, and that is that 80% of our people don't use the insurance, but 20% of them are, and those 20% are triggering 80% of those costs. And then the other statistic, which is what we just have to face, and that is that the older you are, and as life takes its toll on you, there are medical conditions that you encounter that are attributable to just age in and of itself. And one can expect that any in our population group is an aged population group. And so as a result of that, we're faced with the challenges of an older population group, and it continues to increase. And on page, go ahead.
I guess the kind of backing up a second here is in 2003-2004 it increased 3.6%, and the next year it was 10%. I mean, 8% is a big jump. Is there something in particular that happened that year that, I mean, did we have a bunch of baby boomers jump
on?
I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
I guess
Mr. Chair,
good question. Yeah.
Yes, I do have a response to that. That in the 2003-2005 round of bargaining, there were dramatic changes in our plan design, and there was more what I would call responsibility placed on the employee regarding decisions on how they would use health care. And that's where we basically ended up with that one year where we had zero premium increases. There were dramatic changes in how people utilized health care. And for that period of time, those numbers dramatically decreased, and now it's stabilized again. It's stabilized, and so now we're reflecting based on what we would call common utilization. Had those changes not been there, those increases would have been dramatically higher than what you're seeing. So it's really kind of what I would call a bump in the road, or a huge bump in the road.
So it makes it, I would say, too. Obviously. Yeah, Senator Kilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're not Senator yet. Whose place would you be taking if you did that?
Senator Scheid.
Oh, no. You're representative. Yeah, we like Senator Scheid a lot. Okay, we like you, too.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. In looking at these numbers, the projected annual premium, for example, is 504.6. And then I look that the medical claims for 05 were $435 million. So do you keep a certain balance on hand to take care of this? Are we self-insured, or are we paying someone else? I'm just trying to get a sense of how this works. And if our average cost is about $3,482 per member, when I divided the number of employees by the total amount projected to spend, I came out to about $10,500 per person. Is the people who are using the extra care using up a lot more than that, or does there tend to be a balance carrier? How does that work?
Balances to reserves.
That's Mr. Chair, Representative.
I think she's getting at the reserves and what's in our reserves. That was one of the questions what the teachers' unions want to do or still want to self-insure. And they keep talking about the reserves everybody else that gets into the business has to have reserves.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, first, I think just a quick clarification to your point about the average costs. The numbers on page 7 represent the cost for our total program. Mr. Larson mentioned there are 115,000 covered lives. Of those, 48,000 are active employees or in our pool as employees, but the remainder is about 115,000. So that's the denominator when you're dividing. It's 115,000 rather than 48,000. As to the reserving issue, we are a self-funded program, which means we, the state, are responsible for paying all the medical claims as they come in, as well as the administrative costs of having people like Mr. Larson and I employed, as well as the costs we pay to the health plans for administering the program on our behalf. There are two types of reserves that are typical in health insurance programs. We have both types. One is a cash flow reserve. It's also called an incurred but not reported. And it's just simply some money set aside, recognizing that on any given day, somebody has gotten some care and there's still a bill to be coming in to be paid. And so we have that reserve at the level that is typical for that IBNR. And it just simply represents a cash flow.
Mr. Chair, yeah. How much?
I'll have to check and get back to you. I believe the current processing time is assumed, I think, to be in the neighborhood of about 2 weeks for the IBNR, but I'll certainly check on that and get back to you. It might be a little bit higher than that.
You don't have any catastrophic, or do you have any catastrophic insurance that you guys buy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that gets to the second kind of reserve that we have, which is called a contingency reserve. We buy an aggregate stop loss. The stop loss amount is set very high, 125% of the total premium. It would be truly a catastrophe if we ever reached that level. But we have that kind of protection. In addition, we also have a contingency reserve for what would still probably be some catastrophes, but a little bit more minor kinds of catastrophes, to really protect us in that corridor from 100% to 125%. And that's been established by looking at best practices, talking to our actuaries, and that I believe now is in the range of about 12 to 16% is sort of the accepted norm for that contingency rate.
12 or 15% of the annual premiums or something?
Mr. Chair, yes, that would be 12 to 15% of that, in this case, approximately $500 million this year. Yes.
Representative Lady.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions on page 9. The 20% of the members that incurred nearly 80% of the claims, does that include retirees?
Sir, whoever wants. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, these numbers, as I understand it, are reported on our active pool, which could include some of those under age 65 employees that Mr. Larson was talking about, as well as any active employees over age 65.
But it wouldn't include retirees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, this number, to my understanding, would not include retirees over age 65.
Mr. Chair, follow up on that. Do you have an age distribution on the 20%? Is it kind of across the board, or is it weighted, as you've indicated in the next bullet here, that the older members, 51-plus, cost nearly twice as much? Is it the over 51 that really make up the bulk of the 20%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I do have with me... Steve Berkland from our risk management. He might be able to answer that question, but I think I can answer the question, which is it's dramatic that the older population is the one that is attributing to these costs. Do you have that, Steve?
You're right.
I mean, it's and some of that is going to be represented in the slides that I'm going to continue on with. But yes, if you take the cost attributable, just take a segment of our population from age 20 to 30, and take a slice of our population from 50 to 60, the costs are dramatically higher, just in the general use of our insurance.
Let me just make a comment. I'm told that the House is having a caucus at 9:30, and I don't want. If Democrats, Republicans, doesn't matter, and then you're in session at 10, is that correct?
Yes.
So maybe we can move along a little bit. I mean, these are important questions, though, too. Maybe we have to come back, I don't know, but we do have to be out here by 9:25.
Okay, we'd be happy to come back.
Mr. Chairman, if I just one follow-up.
Because this is really important stuff, so if it takes another day, I that doesn't trouble me, because this is big.
Just one last follow-up question. Given the fact that you've got a huge percentage of our state employees that are expected to retire here in the next few years. I'm trying to remember what that percentage was, but the 40% sticks in my mind. Is there some potential light at the end of the tunnel here? I mean, if we've got a big bulge now of employees that are going to be retiring, and you said the trend line on retirees signing up is going down, is there some potential light at the end of the tunnel in terms of our costs here, given what's ahead of us on retirees?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I think there is, and I also we're not losing sight. I think we've got a lot of ideas in place on how we can manage these costs. A lot of the costs that are attributable to that age population group are costs that we still can contain, and I'm going to get to some of that in here. But what's interesting in that is that the last time I looked at our statistics, the average age of a new hire in the state employees was around 35. And I started with the state when I was 22. And so it's kind of interesting about the population.
How old are you, 22?
Thank you. No, I'm 28.
Oh, all right. But I'll continue to go through. On page 12, for example, is a chart, and I think this gets to Representative Lanning's question, and this is the graph that just shows per member per year in 2005. You can see the age population from 0 to 20. Obviously, we don't have zero, $1,800. If you're 51 and above, the costs are over $6,000 a year, and that's just the slice of our age population. Costs on the bottom of that page there. In 2005, this just shows where the cost distribution is. You can see, and that number does total to $435 million. You can see the distribution of the costs that we have. On page 14, again, where I've talked about 20% of our members are attributing to the cost, you can see we have a paradigm here where you can see that the far left in the boxes there, which is approximately 80% of our population, those are where we want to keep our people. And how we're doing that, in the second box, we're doing health risk assessments, we're doing health coaching, we're providing incentives, we're doing programs to keep people from moving further and further to the right. Because once you get into the chronic illness, where we have heart disease, diabetes, depression, and so on, those are the costs that are attributable to those increases. And what we're trying to do is continue to keep people out.
You know, in this job, we're all depressed. At certain times. Not all of them.
You can then see that on page 15, we're in the second year of our health care assessment. 49,000 people signed up for the health care assessment. There's an incentive to do that because $5 is taken off your office copay. Of that, you can see that of 70% that took the health care assessment, the disappointing news was 16,000 of our employees have been determined to be high risk. And so those are the people that we want to target to try to keep out of that high-risk cost state for us. And of that 16,000, only 4,600 agreed to be contacted by the health coach. And that's what we're trying to encourage. What we've identified in our health risk assessment, and that is that sheep, our population, we have nutrition, weight, physical inactivity, and we have then the other statistics there, which is attributing to our cost. Now, I think one of the good news information that we have is only 12% of our population smokes, which from a nationwide point of view is dramatically lower than what is found out there.
Representative Bigham.
Real briefly, has there been any results or any information about those filling out the questions online and stuff like that and lowering the costs or any cost effect or cost benefit analysis type stuff up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, we're still in the early stages on this, but we call it ROI, return on investment.
Yeah.
And the health plans are, this is already has already been established that if you can keep people from moving into those high disease states, yes, there is. And the I've yet to see any population studies where we've totally ignored a group just to see what happens. But the healthcare assessment now is becoming a feature in just about every health plan, and
yeah,
what we're running into is whether or not we make it mandatory or not. We're still optional. We've got incentives for people to
yeah
do that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any problems with it. I just think that
yeah
I would at some point like to see if you have any studies saying that the people that fill this stuff, you know, fill out all the personal online questions, that there is cost savings somewhere in the line for doing it, because otherwise it's basically it's just taking a survey to see how many people smoke, how many people are overweight, and how many people do this, that, and the other thing. So,
it's certainly a big risk factor, too, is heredity.
Yeah.
That's it.
Senator
Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Larson, or Mr. Hogan, I just wondered, I took the assessment. I didn't do it the first year. I didn't know it was the window thing. And I was doing surgery then. But now this last time I was able to do it. What was just fascinating to me was there was no place to say, are you currently sick? So I did this whole health assessment, but no place did I have to say that I was being treated for cancer. And so I thought, and so when the person called me, I'm one of those 4,000 something, okay, yeah, I do that. Even though I think they're nagging me sometimes. yeah, I think that's just a fantastic program. I mean, it really is helpful. But I don't know if you know that they do that or that they don't ask that. Or not. I mean, like, even if I just had a heart attack, I don't think it asks that. I mean, and there's no place really to put that in. I'm curious about that.
Senator Metzen, Senator Scheid, that's a good question. Last year was our, you know, when we first broke into it, that was the first time
okay
we did this. We're in the second. You know, we've had a variety of issues, and I'll duly note your point on that, that we can share with the health plans regarding, you know, I had one of the complaints one time. They said, well, they're asking a question about, do you have guns in your house? Why is that associated with that? And so those are the things that I get fielded, and I have to work with our risk management group on that. But these are, and they're different. Each health plan has a different one. We've been asked, why don't you have them all the same? And these are legitimate questions, and we're working on that. And you know, it takes time, but I think that you raise a very good point, and I'll get back to you on that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Secretary Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scheid, you're far more kind than I am with the assessment.
Oh.
When they called me at the end of it and were nagging me, I told them when they had someone who had been overweight most of their life, lost weight, and kept it off for 10 years, they could call me back. Otherwise, don't bother.
They do nag you.
They quit calling.
Okay.
Well,
I represent. There you go.
Elstra.
Thanks. Good luck, I heard.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We see that 70% took the health assessment. Do we have any sense on if that was the healthier portion or what population of the 80-20 group, that's the 20% of the at risk, really took the assessment?
One of the things that we've put, the assurances that we've instilled with our employees is that there is a complete firewall between our claims use and the health risk assessment. And the health plans have gone to great extents to make sure that there's no break in that firewall. So I guess I can get back to you if I'm not answering the question correctly, but my answer to that is no. What this is because you can go in right now and get in and do that health care assessment. It's just that we have the link that you get the $5 break on the office visit copay. But for us to be able to say, okay, now we want to take the high utilizers of our insurance and determine whether or not they did the health care assessment, I don't think we're there. And I don't think we'll get there either. And there's this, a lot of the issues regarding the health care assessment was confidentiality. And I was mixed about that because the health plans have all of the information if you're paying your claim costs, but they have a complete firewall in that database, and they do not commingle. But of those that did, you know, so 70% of our population did it because of the $5 off because of copay break, and up 34,000 of the 49,000 that were eligible took it, and 70% were considered to be at least identifiable in the health risk assessment as having some issues. Now, was it attributable to those 20% group? I don't know.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Elsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually quite comforted by that because I think you'll get a better sense. People will be more willing to participate if they don't believe that their employer has access to that information. I was one of those people who was at risk and then had gastric bypass surgery to take care of the issue, but they didn't quite know what to do when one segment was trying to advise you and the other segment was treating you.
Right.
And so it was helpful in that they were calling and bugging me, but it became unhelpful when I was actually doing something about it. So
okay.
Well, let's get more.
Well, okay, on page 17,
kinder and gentler.
A comment on that would be
when they take the assessments, you've got to be kinder and gentler.
That as we continue to improve Advantage, and I think this would be applicable, the bottom two bullets, one of the things that of the two that we have is we've created Minute Clinics, for example. We've made that an option for us, which there's an incentive for our employees to use Minute Clinics. And then we also created a program called Advantage Health Advisor and Representative Hillstrom. This is what we would call a health ombudsman, so to speak, that you can call and you can get coaching information on healthcare questions that you have. It's a feature that we've set up with our Advantage members. And they've done an outstanding job in putting this program together when you just need answers that you feel that you're not getting from your health care provider. And that this has been in place now for about a year, and we've been marketing this, and it's working very well for us. Okay, I know we're running up against the clock. I guess I'd like to, I'll move as fast as a couple other points on page 18, what we're moving into next. We have created a program called Bridges of Excellence where we've identified certain health providers that have performance measurement standards that are significant enough that we're providing incentives for them. And then also what you hear and what you have is best in class, which is commonly referred to as centers of excellence. And we're moving into certain medical conditions that bariatric surgery, transplants, and so on, that we're going to be providing incentives for employees to go to certain hospitals for those medical procedures. And there's two features of this. Just being recognized as one of our centers of excellence may in and of itself be enough to for the hospital to strive to have that status. But in any event, we're also looking that we would provide incentives for our employees to go to those certain hospitals for that procedure. Now, getting into the bargaining. Okay, we need, if you look on page 9, with 12% premium increases each year, for the next
for the 2 years of insurance for 2008 and 2009, and this is by now, and this is the biennial cost, Mr. Chair. I need $174 million in new money if we're going to live with the status quo and not make any changes. Okay, and you can see on the bottom of page 19 the distribution of the costs of our insurance. The state pays 91.4% of the costs. The employee picks up 8.6%. Our opening proposal that we put on the table with the unions, in order to, what I did was, in order to capture that $174 million, on page 20. Okay, on page 20, and this is the cost distribution of our opening proposal. We put $50 million of new money on the table in our opening proposal. We do have a proposal on the table that single employees would now pay 15% toward the premium, which is currently free for single employees, and that will generate $75 million for us. And then I made up the other $45 million in plan design changes. And while that may be somewhat controversial, I think it's responsible on my part to figure out how I'm going to reach that $140 plus million. Some other proposals that we have, Mr. Chair, and that is we're also proposing that your spouse fill out the health care assessment instead of the voluntary coaching, which we have right now, that you have to agree to the health care coaching. And then in doing so, following up with these, if you have a what we consider to be a chronic medical condition, we're going to provide incentives for those employees and their families on the prescription costs for certain maintenance drugs that they're required to take, or possibly a health reimbursement account. We've also put on the table that for people who want to quit smoking, that a, what we have is a registered nicotine replacement program through their health care provider, that we will be providing that at no cost. And then also we have proposals that if you're on any kind of maintenance drug, there will be a break in those costs as well. So I think it's important, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that, that while you've seen our opening proposal on the cost, we are continuing to try to provide cost breaks for our employees that are utilizing our insurance, and still providing the incentives that, like the point you raised, Representative Lanning, and that is what are we doing to keep those people in that lower, to the left of that design box, without by putting them into more cost issues.
Okay, I think I think we got through this thing, didn't we?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes for March 27th.
Okay, Representative Bingham moves the minutes. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. I think it was a pretty good discussion. Thank you very much. I've only been around here 30 years, so this helps me a little bit.
Every time.
Lily, were you listening?
I was paying attention, sir.
All right, good. All right, I think that is it. I'm going to have a little more time for questions, but I think you can always get a hold of Mr. Larson or other folks. Okay?
Good meeting.
Meeting adjourned. Thank you.